decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. This is now the eighth night, and there are four streams coming tonight. In 2 hours, it'll be The Woodlander, and then Red Ice, and then Jeremy McKenzie, Raging Dissident. But first, it is a regular stream that we have each year, and it is with UK Column. I'll let Brian Gerrish introduce himself and UK Column. Brian, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you very much indeed. My goodness, the time goes quickly, doesn't it? Because I'm thinking to myself, it only seems a few months ago that we were doing one of those. And I'm going to add that I don't accept that it's just a question that time goes faster just because you're older, because I'm talking to a lot of younger people these days who say it's unbelievable how quickly the time goes. So maybe that's a subject to discuss on itself. But who am I? Well, I'm one of the founders and editors, if you like to use that term, of the UK Column. We are a web-based media outlet. We've been going for about 16 years, I think it is now, producing online news and also written material, seminars. We do some live conferences as well, but essentially we're there because we've been trying to tell the truth, and we've been trying to get facts and analysis out to the wider UK public and people overseas. And I'm delighted to say that this evening I've got with me Alex Thompson, who came to join the UK Column team and get involved. Alex, I can't remember how many years ago, but it was a lot, 10.
It was a full 10 years.
10 years. And also we got Ben Rubin, who's a relative newcomer. So I'm going to say the youngster. And Ben's been with us and helping us produce the news production for the last year and a little bit, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah.
Just Ben, over a year, Brian, yes.
Yeah. Ben was on the last year's stream, so yes, it's definitely a year. Alex, would you like to introduce yourself?
I've been with the UK Column team, as Brian says, over a decade. I've been presenting since 2014. I actually came on board behind the scenes in 2013, and that was when UK Column News had only just taken to the internet, not long before you did your internet shows, Colin. So that was when it was all new, and we might, for the technically interested, perhaps briefly get into the evolution of the platforms, which is something that I know that in previous years you have discussed with some of the guests, where the reach is. But it was developing out of the newspaper era into the news commentary era that I came on board, and my specialisms have always been international, particularly Eastern Europe ones, because of my past as a British spy focusing on that part of the world, and increasingly theological issues for those interested in them. We have a large Christian viewership. We talked about it a little last year, that a lot of our viewership was very sharply polarized after the 7th of October 2023. So the UK Column audience, as it is with us now, I think, is fairly agreed, not in degree, but in principle, for example, on the wrongness of the way in which Israel is pursuing its war, and would also line up with the same skepticism about Ukraine. So there is a geopolitical alignment there. We do not focus only on geopolitics. We're better known in the early years for Brian's campaigning on very much domestic issues. Even though we were very strongly against EU membership, we were always pointing out that fraud and corruption at local level, child abuse by our own native politicians, was far more of a basic problem to contend with than what foreigners were doing to us. So that's always been our approach. I have been presenting a bit less regularly towards the second half of this year. That's not, as a few of our viewers have expressed the worry that I'm less committed to UK Column. It is rather that I'm doing a lot more Bible translation than ever. And we have talked about that in some previous millennials as well, that even those of the audience, your audience, that are not Christians as well, and you address this in a couple of your set piece speeches to Erkenbrand when you used to come over to the Netherlands, they are interested in the preservation of learning. And a large part of that is our classical languages. And for my part, that would be Hebrew, Greek, although Latin's not biblical, it's in the same category as far as I'm concerned. That is increasingly a life calling. It's not displacing UK Column, but it is taking a lot of my time because it's a kind of legacy issue that when you're in your, well, I'm in the second half of my 40s now, you don't want to neglect that because you just don't know how many years of health and vigour remain to you. So those are the things that we focus on at UK Column right now.
Yes, I can identify with that, actually, because over the last year, I've started really getting into historical research about things that aren't political. Well, they're kind of political, but not really, not always. So it feels important. It feels like something that I should be doing. So I can completely understand what you mean there. Ben, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hello, everyone. It's great to be here. Thanks for having us back. So I'm Ben Rubin, and as Brian said, I've been working with the Column for just over a year. I started doing the news at the beginning of October. In fact, it was the 6th of October. I remember the date being the 6th because it was the day before that big momentous event took place in the Middle East that we hear so much about and is continuing to have so many big knock-on effects. And before that, I spent, about 17, 18 years in the consulting industry, and that involved advising predominantly big corporations on how to make more money, generally using digital technology. So I really specialized in digitization of the economic system and these things being rolled out everywhere, right? So the migration from an old-fashioned bricks and mortar call center based operating model for the bank or for the retailer or whoever it might be, and flipping them from that into this kind of brave new world of digitization, applications, artificial intelligence, all the kind of stuff that is becoming completely ubiquitous. They want it to become completely ubiquitous across the whole system, right? You know, whether it's the NHS or, you know, any kind of government interaction they're talking about now, there's this big push toward digitizing the state. And I was right in the thick of that for a long time. We were operating at very senior level. So the stuff we were doing was strategically important in every industry. Still is today, really, but certainly for about 5 or 6 years towards the end of that streak of my career, we were going into boardrooms and we were talking to top people about the transformation of their industry and their organization within it, retraining their people, re-engineering, retooling all of their internal processes. And I was working in a small boutique consulting firm that was pretty good, pretty successful. But we then got acquired by one of the big international management consultancies, and we were then plugged into their European advisory business. And I basically spent just under 2 years having quite privileged, not completely unique, but like pretty unique access to the full scope of what the big international advisory firms do for their clients, right? Like literally, what does a big four firm or a big three strategy firm do for a big international corporation across most of the industries that they operate in? Less so in government, because I didn't really like working with government at the time. I was much preferred the markets. It's less bureaucratic, and you know, you can go and talk to a decision maker and you can work with them immediately rather than having to go through all the kind of procurement processes that you get in the public sector. And I was enjoying doing that, and I learned a lot about the way that the economic system worked. But then towards probably about 2018, 2019, something just began to not quite sit right with me. And sort of in hindsight, I realized that I was developing an intuitive sense that the natural end point of all of this digitization and all of this technology and the platforms that were being built was actually a real a danger, frankly, to humanity. Like, that's what we were looking at. We still are looking at now. And I've begun to reject it at quite a profound, deep, almost like a spiritual level. I couldn't even articulate it really at the time, what was going on. And that was combined with a whole bunch of personal things that I was going through at the time. And then when 2020 hit, and I was sort of out of the system a little bit at that point, and but still with a lot of knowledge about how it worked on the inside, and I could see what the big companies and these consulting firms were helping to roll out, i.e. with all of the COVID response and these digital control platforms and the ID systems and all of this stuff, I realized that actually this was, frankly, profoundly evil, and it needs to be called out. And, you know, I'll hold my hands up and say, you know, in my naive state of working professionally, I had played a role in helping to progress some of that stuff. But then when I realized where it was all going to, I have just been trying to point out the corruption and to articulate to people what the dangers are. And that's what I've been doing for the past year and a bit at UK Column. And I was doing it for a bit before that on Substack, you know, as a sort of free agent. And basically those tools and the knowledge that I've developed over that nearly 20-year career, it turns out to be quite useful doing this kind of work, basically, and just looking at these networks of interconnected organizations, people and programs of activity and different agendas, and just explaining what they're all about, and you know, the fact that maybe most of them, if not all of them, are not a net good for humanity, and maybe we should take a different approach, you know. So
yeah, that's what I'm here. When you mentioned digitization, and you also mentioned the NHS, and I couldn't help remembering that the NHS actually lost my medical records because it was all paper. It was a folder that it was at my GP's office up in Scotland. And at some point, because I moved quite a lot, you know, London, back to Scotland, and so on. And in one of these moves, they lost it. I still don't know. It's never been recovered. This was many years ago, 10, 15 years ago. So I can understand from that point of view, it obviously did. And this is the whole thing. Digitization is convenient. There's a drama from 1971, TV drama called The Guardians. And it's about a totalitarian future Britain. And in that, in 1971, there's a character saying ID cards would be very useful, very convenient, because it's all of your information in one place, and it's backed up on a central computer. So if you lose the card, it doesn't matter. 71. I was astonished when I saw that, and because that was just after I saw that about 5 years after New Labour's push for ID cards, and now it's coming back again with digital ID. Brian, perhaps you could take this question. What do you think are, I mean, obviously, it is convenient. Digitization is convenient. But we also seem to be, as a result of digitization, we seem to be moving into a mode where nothing is ever forgotten. Everything is somehow retrievable. Do you think that's true? Do you think we will get to that point? And what do you think will be the effects on people, on humanity, on life with that kind of thing? Brian?
What a good question. Are we moving to a point where everything's going to be digitized and we're going to have a record of everything we do? In my opinion, absolutely. Because we're moving into a political control structure that has to know everything about us in order to ensure that we will do everything the state wants. And if we don't, it will know and we can be dealt with appropriately. So the growing digitization, although it has got areas which you can look at and say, well, actually, that makes sense and that can simplify things. We've got digitized medical records so that when you move areas, those digitized medical records can be called up wherever you are, and they're the same record, and we don't lose paper records. This sort of argument does hold some truth, but the overall plan is clearly not just medical records. It's to have your educational records, to have your crime and behavior records all put together so that the state knows everything about you. And that is to do with complete and utter control. And of course, we get another indication of this recently. I've forgotten the exact name of the initiative, but we are now seeing that the state says that each school child should have a record which records everything. It records all of the exams and the school performance, but it also records if the child should have problems or challenge the system in every way, in any way. So if you look at the breadth and the depth of this digitization, it isn't just covering one subject area, it's covering every subject area, and therefore ultimately the state and its agents, and we are never to know who the people are who will have access to our records, but the state will hold a record of everything about us from the time we are born until the time we die. And if we behave ourselves, that's fine. But if the state doesn't agree with what we're doing and saying, that record is going to be used to control us. I have absolutely no doubt that this is where we're heading.
Well, it wouldn't be that much effort for the state to know or create a system by which it could know what you looked up on the internet, what you did, everything you did on the internet on the 7th of April 2022, for example. Why not? Similarly, where you went on that date and the next week and so on. I mean, traveling.
That's already happening.
It's not good.
The records already exist continually of what you watch on the what you're looking at on the internet, and that's why anybody who's using the internet is experiencing targeted adverts coming up on the internet, because it's already being used. And what was the other thing? So that was one. Oh, and of course, your phone is absolutely, if it's a smartphone, is automatically recording every meter that you travel and where you go. So it's not what if, it's already happening. And the key bit is that in whose hands will this data be? And should we trust these people? Well, of course, your data is going to be in the hands of the same political and security system that is showing itself to be completely untrustworthy, lying, fraudulent, full of corruption. Those are the people who are going to be able to see all of your personal data and control it. So it's already in place. It's not something that's coming.
Yeah. What I meant was, obviously, your ISP is storing this information about what you're looking up on the internet. Your smartphone is recording your, and I've had it where Google sends an email saying, "Here's where you went last month," and it's it is rather alarming. That I remember the first time it happened, I was taken aback. To think that they know everything. They know I went to there. I went to there and there. It's frightening. But of course, the question is the merging of all these, like Google's information with the smartphone's information, with the government's information, with the bank's information about what I bought, where, when. This is what I meant. It could easily all be merged together.
That's Palantir, isn't it? I think Ben should say something more particularly about Palantir, because he's mentioned it several times during the year.
Okay, Ben Palantir. Because I've heard about this. I know that I think Peter Thiel funded it, but I don't know exactly what it is. So please go for it.
Yeah, so I'll get onto Palantir in a moment, if you don't mind, because actually I just want to build on what you've just been talking about there, right? It's actually much more insidious than what you've already described, right? This idea that they can track what you're looking at on the internet on a particular day of the week. Yeah, of course it can. Absolutely. And they've been doing that for years. But then also, what are they doing with your social media stream in order to control you already, right? And Facebook was running mass scale experiments over 10 years ago where they were using the news feed to carry out emotional manipulation on users in order to see if they could actually affect them cognitively and emotionally at scale to affect whatever kind of outcomes they wanted. They were primarily looking at whether we could make you feel happier or sadder, right? Whether we could depress you. Yeah, and they were doing this without any kind of permission. And the people that were responsible for that are the people running. So that, I think that was... Cambridge Analytica was using the tooling that made that possible, but they weren't doing that. That was obviously much... Well, I mean, Cambridge Analytica was doing a lot of things. What it's famous for is the Brexit vote and working with Dominic Cummings and very intelligently, quite frankly, managing a mass communication campaign in order to affect a political outcome. But you can use Facebook, and actually Instagram now is a more advanced iteration of that to do a lot more than that, right? And they're perfectly happy to experiment on you, right? Because they own you, essentially. That's the way that they view it, right? Really importantly. But also, it's much further beyond what you've just described. So if you look at particularly the new the virtual reality and augmented reality glasses, these systems that they're desperately, desperately trying to make mainstream, right? And one of the routes that they're taking to mainstream this tech, because it's not being taken up by certainly not people our age, but actually a lot of people, it's a step too far. You don't need to strap the LED screen to your face. Right, it just feels like a little bit too much. So what they're doing is they're trying to circumvent the adults, and they're going straight into schools, and they're trying to introduce this stuff into schools. And what those systems can do, right, is they're actually tracking your biometric responses. Yeah, so your heart rate, your breathing patterns, whether your eyelids flicker when you're under stress. Right, so they're literally, the predator is right up in your face, tracking you. Tracking how you respond to stimulus that it is providing, right? And this stuff is all being hoovered up into the data platform, and it is available to the people who have access to it. And in a company like Facebook, that's certainly a significant majority of the people who work there, yeah, because there's very little internal guidance or governance around where that data goes to. There are teams all over the place who've got access to it. Right. And but then before you get but beyond that, very quickly, you're getting into the intelligence agencies. And we saw, for example, the relationship that was revealed between Twitter and the FBI and the CIA. And I believe some of the UK intelligence agencies when Musk went in there and begun to open up a little bit of what was going on in the background. Right. So it's much more insidious than I think people quite realize. And with these new platforms, both the devices, so like the on-face stuff that they're really trying to push, but also these kind of algorithmic systems that are coming along, these AI systems, like the level of control that they potentially could have is just, it's unbelievable, right? That you would even seek to develop this kind of power. Right, and they have, and I view this stuff as fundamentally evil. And one of the ways that they are progressing these all-seeing, all-knowing data platforms is through companies like Palantir. Right, so what Palantir is particularly good at, and it was founded by Peter Thiel and Alex Karp, and another guy whose name escapes me. I can't remember off the top of my head now. There were three of them who were the original founders back in, I'm going to say 2001, 2002. So this was post PayPal for Peter Thiel. And it was very famously set up in collaboration with the CIA tech investment fund, which is called InQtel. I'm pretty sure I got that correct. Right, Alex is nodding his head, so I'm going to take that as a confirmation. So it was set up as a joint public-private U.S. military intelligence. Actually, it's not military intelligence, CIA, is it? But U.S. intelligence agency operation, right?
And many of them are military, including NSA, which, unlike the signals intelligence agencies in most of the other Five Eyes countries, is military. Actually, the same is true in Australia because there it's the Defence Signals Directorate. And before I, you know, take you off beam too much, I would add the contractors within NSA, and this came out in the Cambridge Analytica Trump election scam as well, and in the Snowden revelations, the contractors have a bit perfect access in their own pool repository. They have access to all of this stuff. They don't have to pay for the trillion, squillion dollar, you know, sort of county size storage facilities in Utah, because the taxpayer is already doing that from the NSA. But they can go in with their fat pipe and pick out what they want, because there are more contractors than sworn intelligence officers working for NSA. So, yes, to return to the main point that you're making there, military intelligence is not far off beam.
Yeah. And then that's so, and from there, Palantir has expanded out into it's very big in healthcare. It works in a lot in financial services, and also in for military applications as well. They're the kind of big ones. And basically, what they would do inside an organization like the NHS, if you think about the NHS's IT infrastructure, that's built up over 40 years, 50 years. And actually, if you go in some of the banks, they've got core systems that go back to the 60s, right? So some of this stuff's really, really old. And what Palantir do go in is they basically plug their software into the network, and they suck in all of the disparate data that exists across all of the different platforms that are in place across the back end infrastructure of the organization. And they basically virtualize it, suck it in, and then make it interoperable and usable and knowable in an integrated way by the people who run the organization. And that creates an enormous amount of value. Actually, if you're running a big institution like the NHS, it's really useful to know where all your stuff is and how all the different data platforms fit together, and to be able to track all the different assets that you have and where all these different disparate pieces of equipment are around the hospital, and literally right the way down to physical infrastructure. And on top of all of that, they create these management systems that actually, when you look at them, it's almost a bit like SimCity or one of those sort of 90s games where you could basically build a city and decide how all the different bits fit together. And it's obviously more complicated than that, right? But that's the kind of feel that it has. And it basically allows you to apply that kind of layer top down onto the organization and track and manipulate right the way down to like the individual components of the system and the way that people work and the workflows that they adhere to. And, you know, that's a big part of what Palantir are doing. And you know, if you look at military applications, they'll be taking a lot of the stuff that you were talking about. So like social media information and financial transaction records, and they'll be profiling people. And actually they get into what they call the kill chain, basically. It's just like they're selecting targets for the military to go after. And potentially, you know, if you look at like drone fleets to go, you know, if you look at they work a lot with the IDF, they work with the Ukrainian military. So literally, you got to kill that guy, that guy, that guy. Hit yes, and we'll send the drones out, which are also controlled through the platform, and they'll go and execute the mission for you, basically. And it's all run out of these kind of central systems, you know. And those are the same people that are running the IT infrastructure in the NHS.
It's just like dystopian science fiction.
It is. And Palantir in particular is, right, I'll reinforce this point, right, is they run it like an IDF unit, right? That's how they describe it. You know, so they deliberately hire people out of Israeli military and the Israeli government. And you can go and find Alex Karp doing interviews on YouTube with people that have come through this government recruitment process, and they literally talk about it as such. You know,
Alex, would you like to chime in on this?
Well, I've seen this popping up over the years. It's my GCHQ time is now more than 15 years behind me, but there were times when I was on the desk together with the over enthusiastic types who would go out to Israel and liaise with Unit 8200. Which has got a model. At that stage, it was so super secret we couldn't talk about it within the donut. And all of a sudden, it got blown that, yes, we're working very closely with Unit 8200. And Francis Maud, when the Tories came into office in 2010, was blowing his trumpet on that. We were learning, or not we, the deep state, and particularly the corporations who, you know, think of the taxpayer-funded infrastructure as theirs to play with. They regard the Israeli model as superior because, as those over-enthusiastic desk colleagues of mine said when they came back from trips to Israel, it's amazing what they're allowed to do with the data. You know, they were the passive and active, the military and the civilian all in one. You want the guy to be destabilized, zersetzt, as it would be called in Stasi language, then you can use the data to fiddle with his marriage, to sow seeds of doubt about his wife's loyalty, possibly plant some documentary stuff in there. You want the guy to turn on his comrade within his cell, which, you know, if from your perspective, maybe terrorists or dissidents, you sow internecine strife. And that's where JTRIG, a wing of GCHQ, got busy. I'm not suggesting moral equivalence or equivalence of outcome, but equivalence of technique was very much there, learning from Unit 8200. But, you know, what about Unit 8200 itself in Israel? It's the Israeli Military Tech Center and Signals Intelligence Agency. They say unashamedly, we take the best brains and we only keep them in their 20s. We then sow them out into the tech scene in Silicon Valley, in the City of London, in the likes of Palantir, so that they can continue the great work. What would that be? World Zionification, the leveling of all mental opposition.
See, I can imagine also an AI system that just runs on its own and selects targets and just does things, just recommends like a list of recommendations every week. There's this person, there's this person. Look, I've scanned thousands of people this week. I recommend you go after these 20. Someone could say yep. Yay or nay. And then it devises a program of subversion, dismantling of that person's morale, all sorts of things.
And, yep. And maybe another one we excuse me, we should bring in on this is the fact that we now see that we've got Leveson, famous for his work on censorship of the media, as far as I'm concerned, a few years ago. He's now looking at how we're going to essentially get rid of juries and just have judges in court supported by AI. And so, well, yep. Judges have got to be paid and they can be troublesome. So where are we going to move to? You're going to be judged and tried by AI. And that's a very interesting concept because some things will have gone out the window. One of them's going to be love and compassion because those are not going to be attributes of the AI system. It's going to be cold and calculating in order, presumably, to protect the state. And these are coming through very quickly in front of our eyes at the moment. And I just want to go out.
Just before you go on, yeah. Brian, I'll point out, you'll remember Blake 7.
Yes.
You and I are probably the only two who are familiar with that. But in the first episode of that, this, what you're describing actually happens, and that's supposed to be like 1,000 years in the future, where a man is judged by computer. I mean, yeah. I'm laughing. I don't know why I'm laughing, because it's deadly serious.
Yeah,
because that literally was a dystopian science fiction thing. But it's not 1,000 years, and it's 40 years in the future. And now you're saying that is at least conceivable at this point.
Yeah, but we should laugh, and let's, you know, with the end of the year. So I think we should emphasize this. The reason why we should laugh is because the people ranged against us are very disturbed if we remain happy and we laugh, because their job is to make us sad and depressed, and probably if they can manage it, that we dispose of ourselves. So remaining happy is a very strong part of the battle. And having said that, I just wanted to remind our audience that when Alex was talking about Francis Maude MP, he was a cabinet minister, and he was busily crowing about the fact that UK was now fully engaging with Israeli unit 8200, and also that Israeli intelligence system was going to be embedded in partnership programs with our universities. So it wasn't only security bodies that were going to be working with the Israelis, it was also going to be the educational facilities. But what was Francis Maude's job at the time? He was Minister of Transparency. His job was to speak the truth and show that the Conservative Party was squeaky clean. You could not make this up.
Yeah, it's almost Blairite in its deception.
Very much so, because when the Blairites were running the show, including the last year of under Brown, but still the Blairite wing, that was the last year or two of my GCHQ service, and the briefings that we got, particularly with regards to the then completely denied relationship with Israel as a signals intelligence partner, was don't let MPs, and I think in one or two briefings they did actually say don't let Labour MPs know about this. They might say, I am a representative of the people, I'm in the legislature, I have a right to know, and of course they will be right. Likewise, a judge can ignore classification, because classification is set by an executive only for the executive branch, so that's something we don't want the people to know, so let's keep intelligence out of court and out of parliament was the idea. But what they were saying back then was, these Labour MPs, this is of course in the time when Corbyn hadn't even yet become leader, let alone the purging of the old guard, the Corbynistas. The idea was Labour MPs won't go along with this. And I don't want to be making a party political point in that sense, but I will say that after 2010, many things did shift. And the nascent UK column reporting of that time picked up on it very strongly, that the Cameron, Clegg, Maude line was, we're going to be in your face about it. And I think that's the particular wing of Zionism with which we were as a government in bed during that transition that was funding our politicians was very much happier with what it got in that era than what it had with Brown. And when it saw the prospect of a Corbyn government, it said, no way, we're going to have to slap a Zersetzung on this Corbyn and cast him out into outer darkness. But that normalisation has now been so thoroughly completed that the gutted Labour Party has actually been the vehicle of preference. And in terms of data management, the interesting thing is that this election victory, and of course at UK Column we don't believe in party politics, we think it's unconstitutional, and we, you know, risk of stating the obvious, we don't believe a difference is affected by electing for a different party. But the thinking has now, you know, got to the stage that a Starmerite party is preferable, and we do it. The engineers do it by getting the Conservative voters to stay at home. The Labour Party got far fewer popular votes this last general election than before, continuing a trend of fewer and fewer people voting for Labour, both percentage-wise and in total votes. But because of the dramatic stay at home or voting for reform by the Conservatives, you get a Labour government.
Yeah, they got 20. I believe it was 20% of the vote, which was lower than they'd got in 2019, and yet it resulted in a victory. I take your point that it sounds like what you're saying is that the deep state, the engineers, will actually alter a party over time so that it's more, it suits their ends, and yes. then they will get it into power. Yes. And then meantime, they'll work on the other one behind the scenes and get it more amenable. And I can see what you're saying about Labour politicians being more averse to this, because the Tory part, the Conservative Party, has long had a reputation for being more in bed with Zionist power, whereas the Labour Party has been a bit troublesome, especially the old left. I think the transition to New Labour was a bit of a watershed there, but still you had a lot of old leftists involved still. And then with Corbyn, that was an interesting... I was writing about the loony left, I was researching about the loony left from the 80s recently, last year, and it seemed that Corbyn was a sort of return to that. And then they had to get that out.
You'll recall, Colin, one of our walkabouts in Rotterdam, where I naughtily pretended when I first met you to be a detective from Police Scotland Hate Crimes Unit. We won't forget that in a hurry. But we went on a walkabout around Rotterdam hosted by Erken Brand. And we came across the SP. They still have it in the Netherlands, the Socialist Party. And they're obviously a lot smaller than the Dutch Labour Party, PVDA, which is a mainline party these days. And these SP campaigners were approachable, aging hippie types, sort of, you know, well-to-do 60-year-olds who were embarrassed about their wealth and whatever. But if you recall, they said, oh, very nice to meet you. You're from Britain. Ah, well, you see, we're the Corbyns in the Netherlands. We're the real socialists.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But that can easily be mocked, pilloried by the Blair type as a hippy-dippy, loony left, and idealistic and naive and so on. And it kind of is, actually. I mean, that's kind of true, because the Blairite is far more of a realist. It's far like a Machiavellian sort of. This is the power structure. This is, we have to interact with it. We have to reason with it. We have to negotiate with it and join it in order to get power.
It's Mandelsonian guile, isn't it? I'm convinced, yes. Mandelson was the man actually running that administration.
Yeah. Well, he was, see, again, I did, in my research, I found that he was recommending this kind of thing as far back as, I think, the late 80s. That was when he first became a figure in Labour, like a known influencer, if you like. And he was trying to get Kinnock to do this kind of thing. For all I know, he was involved with various decisions that Kinnock made, like with the EU and so on. But I don't know that for sure. But yes, so... I think what we've been talking about lends itself naturally to what you asked to talk about, which is the transformation of democracy into a mirage. Brian, would you like to start us on that topic?
Well, that's that's a really good sort of question, but there's so much. Where do we start? Can we identify that democracy is changing? Well, we've had lots of clues to this. We've seen changes in the party, in the party, so that now the party only has one view. There within a party, you don't get MPs who are actually expressing their individual views on employment or on the NHS. And certainly they're not doing it in front of the camera. If I take my mind back to the 70s or even into the 80s, you would very often see an MP interviewed by the BBC to find out their opinion on what was happening, both politically and on more general subjects in the country. That doesn't happen anymore. And it certainly doesn't happen within the parties. So now we've got presidential image of the parties to the public. You only hear what the leader has to say or one or two key people. And then in addition to that, and we know this in particular, if you challenge an MP on a particular topic, you ask them why we're permitting, let's be a little bit provocative here, why we're permitting so many Ukrainians to simply come into this country at the moment. You will almost never get a reply directly from the MP. They will revert to their party HQ in order to give you the policy answer. And what they might also do is go to the House of Commons library. In their mind, that will be because that's an independent source of research and factual information. Whereas, in fact, we believe the opposite is true. But what you get back is a letter, which is always the line. It's no longer what that MP thinks. And then, of course, the other thing you can see, which has happened really over the last 15, 20 years, is absolutely no substantive parliamentary debate on key issues, whether we were going to supply arms to Ukraine, as an example, or arms to Israel. Absolutely no debate in Parliament. That was simply a decision that was made within Cabinet, at Cabinet level, by the Prime Minister and whoever of his accolades he wanted to bring on board. So that's been happening at the parliamentary level. At the same time, you're seeing an equivalent parliamentary system coming into local authorities. So that if you take the average city council, I could choose Plymouth City Council or Glasgow City Council or Sheffield City Council, it now operates in a party political form where the key officers work within a cabinet. So the elected members, chosen elected members, form a cabinet. The chief executive of that council will be part of the cabinet. And so will, I can't think what they call them, but effectively it's a political officer of the council that monitors the standards of the elected members. So then the decision-making process at lower level, at the local level, is simply being made not by all of the elected members going into the council chamber and debating. It's simply a very small number of people within the cabinet system inside the council that make that decision. And then the bit that is smearing the whole of the democracy is that the policy papers, which should come out of debate at the parliamentary level by elected parliamentary representatives, they are not determining policy. That policy is pre-ordained policy, invariably coming out of organisations like the United Nations or the World Economic Forum, for example, or think tanks, Bill and Melinda Gates, or the Blair's Global Foundation. Those policies are being brought into Westminster and then rubber-stamped as if they were debated policy, and those same policies are also being brought directly into local council level where they are rubber stamped. And what sort of policies am I talking about? Well, it's going to be everything to do with the Agenda 2030 policy. So it's going to be to do with climate change, it's going to do with health security, it's going to do with control of the land, and particularly the removal of land from farming. So if I look at our so-called democratic system now, it simply doesn't exist. It looks as though it does, but if you follow the way it works, there is no democratic debate by elected members to form policy. They are simply rubber stamping it.
It sounds like, as I can remember when you were talking about common purpose an awful lot, and it sounds like that writ large, just replicated across the country, that kind of mentality of, managerialism and secrecy.
I would agree with that, because when I look back at what I discovered around common purpose. And I now can look back on that and consider other things that I've seen. In my opinion, common purpose was a Trojan horse. It was the Trojan horse that started the behavior modification, that's changing people's behaviors, but also controlling debates. It's very closely linked with things like the Delphi technique, the control of meetings to get a preordained result. That these techniques were then expanded across government, and we absolutely know from the government's behavioral insights team that that team, using psychological control, behavior modification, the so-called nudging, was not only unleashed on the public, it was also unleashed on the civil service and MPs themselves. So
aim in each case to tell officials, parliamentarians, council people, there are no limits to your power. The people under you are as putty in your hands. So in a word, and this is why UK Column hammers the Constitution so much and has a dissident's guide to the Constitution, which we'll be reviving in the new year and as a Constitution section, they never talk about the coronation oath, because there all branches of government, the executive, the parliament and the legislature, executive, parliament and judiciary, all undertake to govern us according to prearranged, set, God-given, inalienable, immutable individual rights, not to be buggered about with, not to have our minds reframed, not to be optimized. And all that we've been discussing this evening is predicated upon, no, you are raw materials for a corporation or for a vision of the world. And from the time people go through school and university through to when they're taken onto the job, whether it's private or public sector, they are deliberately not told that there are any constitutional limitations. And you can say that's the king's fault because he's broken the oath and everyone is acting in his name. Absolutely it is, or in the republic, the president's fault. But ultimately it's the electorate's, the people's fault. As you want, the big theme we're raising here is democracy. We have permitted it to happen. We have not insisted on the obedience to the coronation oath. And we're now losing juries, both north and south of the border, because we are content to let the professionals judge us in a way that our forefathers would have gone to their graves defending and often did.
Ben, I'll ask you to chime in on this in a moment. But first, I just want to bring in this latest thing, which I think is part of what you're talking about, which is the Labour plan to abolish many county councils throughout England. And one of the headlines here was Labour to turbocharge decentralisation with devolution by default plan. And Scrump on Telegram, a channel on Telegram, said devolution by centralisation. Reality in the media is about the framing of events. So Labour's plan for change will deliver the biggest transfer of power out of Westminster to England's regions for a century. And Scrump's comment on this was, this will gut local councils and create huge mega councils headed by Westminster bubble mayors who will be centrally controlled via a council of regions and nations. So it'll be 100 mini Holyrood assemblies all wrapped up in endless process with ultimate decisions made from above. This is the first step in constitutional reshaping of Britain. So the idea here is that they're going to devolve power downwards, but only by appearance. So what will actually happen is it's just stretching Westminster's power into all the provinces. Ben, would you like to take this up?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, we've been talking about this on the news over the past couple of weeks. I'll just pick up on something that Brian was talking about the think tank space and common purpose, and a great example, probably the best exemplar of a UK-focused think tank. You've got the big international ones. You've got the Blair Institute for Global Change. You've got Bill and Melinda Gates. We talked about some of those. But the one I'm tracking in the UK is Demos. Right? And Demos was set up in the early 90s by Sir Geoff Mulgan. And in the very early years, they actually shared an office with Common Purpose. Right. So they were very, very closely physically aligned as well as ideologically aligned. Right. And Julian Middleton and Jeff Mulgan are very close old friends. Right. Mulgan then subsequently, well, actually in the 80s, he was the editor of Marxism Today. So that gives you a sense of his kind of ideological perspective. And then he was the director of political strategy for Blair in the first Blair, or maybe the second Blair government, actually. So this was sort of early 2000s, right? So that was Demos, and it's been running since then. And the past few years, it's been through various different iterations, but it's now, for my money, dictating terms to the Labour government. They're effectively writing the policy recommendations that the Labour government is using to run the country, right? There were three reports that I talked about over the past couple of weeks. The first one, people should go and read these, by the way. Very easy to find on the internet. Go and have a look at it. If you want to understand how sausages are made in the political system, this is a good way to do it. The first one came out in June, and it's called Only We Can Save the State. And it's about Barking and Dagenham, where very famously it's where the old Ford plant was in South East.
It's just come out in a poll this week that it's the least happy London borough as well.
Very famously had, I think, 10 BNP councillors voted onto the council back in the early 2000s. Sorry, Alex.
Sorry about the latency. It just today, Barking and Dagenham, which for our foreign viewers is the depressed borough in the East End of London, which has been completely racially altered, by the way, it came out just this week or even today that Barking and Dagenham is the least happy London borough.
Yeah, right. There was also that film about the women unionising. What was it, Women of Girls of Dagenham or something? I can't remember what it was called. But anyway, sorry, Ben. Go on.
That's a very interesting data point, Alex, that it's the least happy borough, because apparently it's the exemplar borough for the whole country, right? They're basically saying that what we've done here is how the state needs to run. And effectively, what you're looking at is deindustrialization. Yeah, so the Ford plant is closed. All of those working class jobs have disappeared. The traditional social structures that grew up around it, people's capacity to earn money for themselves in order to then, on the back of that, pay a little bit of tax to the local government so that they could run the things that the local government does. All of the kind of market forces have disappeared. So the state is left there and its tax base has disappeared because no one's earning any money anymore. And they're trying to work out how to fund themselves. And they've come to the realization that the best way they think to fund themselves is to go to international capital investors, primarily property developers, and sell them assets, sell them land, sell them council buildings so that they can turn them into flats, so that they can, and the council can then be given that money in place of the taxes that it's no longer able to raise, so that it can then govern the populace. Yeah? And it's very much that mindset. We are going to govern you, and you are going to receive services from us, despite the fact that you aren't actually able, you haven't got gainful employment, you aren't able to earn any wealth for yourself, you're now becoming dependent on us. But in order to fund our operations, we're going to go to the markets, and we're going to effectively implement this corporatist system, the third way system, ultimately, right? It's the total integration of market and state. But what it's removed, a bit like Brian was describing with the court system, is it's removed all the humanity. It's removed all of the kind of social stuff. It's removed all of the what ultimately the church used to be there to do, right, before it got completely destroyed in this country over the past several hundred years, right? But it's completely removed the human spirit from the equation.
The two adjectives that describe equity in judgment, in the church version, it was all things lawful and honest. The clergy must obey their bishop in all things lawful and honest. In continental languages, those adjectives usually turn out as all things which are reasonable and fair. And those are exactly the things that AI cannot do. It cannot, bear in mind that somebody had a reason to break the letter of the law.
Right. And that's what's been taken away in this system, which is becoming increasingly algorithmic and driven by technology. Yeah. So they're very much investing in this and building these all-seeing, all-knowing data platforms about their citizens so that they can be more effectively governed. Right. And this is a Demos report, which essentially is making this as a recommendation for how the country should be run. And you can see how that mentality is playing out writ large across the whole of the Labour government. And you just need to go and look at what Keir Starmer has been doing over the past, not just since he's come into power, but the past several years, going in and out of EY offices, PwC offices, Deloitte, all of these big consulting firms who are World Economic Forum partners in order to tee him up for what he's going to then be put in place to do when he assumes power, when he becomes prime minister ultimately. But people like Demos, that's a particularly interesting report to go and look at, right? Because not least, I mean, I already knew that Barking and Dagenham was in a bad way because I've spoken to people on the ground down there. I didn't know that it's the unhappiest London borough, but apparently they think that this is an exemplar, right? So that's a great example. And then the other big report they put out last week, which feeds directly into this supposed devolution, which you've very rightly pointed out isn't devolution at all. It's actually centralization by stealth, right? So they're going to get rid of the current systems of local governance, which actually allow the counties and the towns to be relatively independent. We're going to scrap all of that, and we are going to put in these metro mayors who are all operating on the same ideological and technical platform that Westminster is. And we're going to do this under the guise of giving you more power and more responsibility. But actually, it's completely the opposite. And that's all being run out of Cabinet Office. Yeah. So this goes right the way to the very center of Downing Street, number 10. And it's being overseen centrally by Starmer, by Pat Buchanan. Have I got the name correct there? Yeah. And Georgia Gould, ultimately, former mayor of Camden. And actually, a lot of this, I was talking about this on the news on Monday this week, a lot of these things have been tested out and in some of the central London boroughs before they're now ultimately being rolled out to the rest of the country, right? And it's a total transformation of the political and the economic system without a single word of discussion at any point about any of it. They're just doing it because they think that they have the right to, and there are no limits on their power.
Yeah. It's quite incredible. Brian, you go.
Well, I just wanted to add to that. So what Ben is saying, of course, is absolutely right. But on top of that, we can see the same agenda is operating in many different countries across the world. The push towards destroying whatever the old democratic system that's in place, getting rid of that and replacing it with the system of mayors, to the effect that we have a global panel of world mayors who are meeting. They're traveling to overseas locations from all different countries to have a discussion within the global mayor system as to how more cities are going to be taken under the control of a mayor. And if I look at this mayoral system, it's a fiefdom. You bring in one person who's in control, and who do they bring in? They bring in all of their collaborators and the team they can trust. What it builds is a fiefdom, a mafia-style control system over each city region. And, you know, we started to get a hint of this when Boris Johnson was mayor of London. But imagine this, when the control of the country is simply exercised through mayors over the key city states in Glasgow, Sheffield, Newcastle, Plymouth, wherever. Yep. Mm-hmm. Democracy at local level within the local councils and the local elections has gone. So this is global policy. It's not UK policy.
Yeah. And then at the global level, each national government isn't independent either. It's just a node of the global governance. So it's actually a fairly continuous line from God knows who at the top to some city mayor to his underlings. Quite incredible. Here's one thing that occurred to me while Ben was talking about councils selling land, selling off assets to private businesses. Because it occurred to me, again, back when I was researching the loony left in the 80s, and by the way, I use that term completely impartially. I actually have some sympathies with them in a way. I don't despise them or whatever. I'm just using it because it's a recognized term. But when I was researching that, the center, the sort of epicenter of this in London was the borough of Brent. And it was run out of this Brent Town Hall, which was a 1930s modernist building. And it was still there up until 10 years ago.
And in fact, just out of view there is the balcony towards the back of the building from this angle, where Mrs. Thatcher waved when she was returned as the Member of Parliament for Finchley, including when she became Prime Minister. That particular balcony became too crumbly for people to stand on, but I've been up to that because my mother was in local government in London.
I didn't know that. So that was where they were until 10 years ago when they moved into this building, which was newly built and designed and so on, at a cost of £90 million. And it's occurred to me, watching footage and photos and so on of the loony left in the 80s, it occurred to me how dowdy and dilapidated everything was. And I thought, and now they're running out of this, and at a cost of £90 million, and I thought, where does the money come from? And I still don't have an answer to this, except perhaps what Ben said, which is private investment.
Brent is particularly Freemason riddled, and the Freemasonry was the previous node of local government around Britain before Common Purpose got going, and overlaps in it with it in time. So in the 90s, my main expertise in this area, very much so. And Brent actually put in, you could almost say, hostile or aggressive bids to take over the statutory services which neighbouring Northwest London boroughs had to provide by law, and said, you know, we will do it for you. So clearly money was coming in from outside. But this is, you know, all that we've been talking about this evening is the idea of regarding people as an investment. Why track the concentration levels of children and their eye movements in class, which is, you know, more advanced in China and in the US than it is in Britain or Europe yet, because the corporations involved regard that person as a lifetime investment. They must remain focused on their task in life and mustn't get distracted.
Right, yes, yeah, the customer is the product, so to speak. It's just an interesting question about how did we go from this kind of thing to this kind of thing? And I guess the answer is PFI, if not PFI Excel, then certainly private investment of different kinds. Would any of you like to comment on that? Because I think it's a key thing. I think it's tangibly see it in the form of the buildings. So it's of interest to me.
Yes, and so there's a few things on that, right? So the first thing is that actually that system that we've just described, where you flog off national assets in order to fund the state, and then the state then governs and provides services to people, but those people don't really actually have a way of making any income because all the industry has been destroyed. That eats itself, right? It is a destructive system, yeah, because you have to keep on throwing in assets that are going to be acquired by international investors in order to keep funding the state so they can keep governing, because there's no income coming, there's no industry, right? You have to understand that. So this is purely destructive, right? It's extraordinarily dangerous, right, when you play it out, right? And it's eating up the cities. You can see it, right? So, you know, first of all, what was wrong with that old Brent building, right? That we should be maintaining these things as assets, that have value that was laid down by our ancestors. I'm not saying that that's the most beautiful building that I've ever seen, but it has some utility, right? And actually, in some ways, it's now being used as a school.
It's now being used as a school, so it's perfectly okay.
Okay, well, it's being used to something. It's being used to something. That's actually quite good, because a lot of the time those things just get bulldozed, right? You know, and actually you can go around any part of London. Actually, if I go back, I went back to Nottingham recently, which is where some of my family still live up there, and you come out of the train station, and I'm looking around, going, "Hang on a minute, there's a new library. Why have they built a new library?" And it looks a bit like that building you've just shown. So they've got this awful modernist architectural style. So it's like, okay, well, how do you
pay for that? It's the PFI style. You know, the biggest in the country in size and cost was the GCHQ donuts that we moved into in 2004, 20 years exactly this year. And at the time, the old Labour, so again, for the foreign or younger viewers, that's the real socialists who were disgruntled but in the party of government under Blair, and still the majority wing, but not in the ministerial positions, they were kept sweet by appointing as Deputy Prime Minister the recently deceased John Prescott, you know, who was supposedly a proud, you know, northern industrial worker and still retained his union membership and whatever, a very corpulent fellow with, you know, quick-tempered and whatever. And so they wheeled him out to keep basically the silly northerners and old-fashioned socialists happy. And when he was given the brief of defending private finance initiatives, PFIs, later they came to be known as PPPs, public-private partnerships, he frankly admitted that there was no money in central or local government to maintain the buildings and build new ones within the public purse. Because he said, you know, come on, everyone, when you want to move into a better house, you want to move in there now, not in 20 years' time. You haven't got the money now, but you move in now and you sign a mortgage. So he was admitting there that the money deliberately was not there. And this is one of Brian's favourite themes, and justly so for many years, that money is deliberately not made available for certain things in order to edge people into a transition. And, you know, as Ben rightly says, that money has been pushed in from elsewhere, which means that, you know, that the public purse is drained. It's running on vapour.
Yeah, incredible. Brian, would you like to chime in on this?
Well, I just think I'd throw an example into the pot, and that was in the late 80s and early 90s, the government started a massive sell-off of Ministry of Defence land and property. And what was this land and property? Well, it was a national asset, and it was simply sold off. In many cases, for it, you know, for the existing buildings to be bulldozed and housing developments to be put up. But nevertheless, an asset which we all owned was simply sold off to a developer because the state could raise money by doing this. So we've seen across the country a massive, massive sell-off of our land and infrastructure, and the money's disappeared.
Of the family silver.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's part of, as much as it's part of this process of this phenomenon of just rank corruption across society, it's also the cultural destruction and degradation of the nation as well, right? Because that's our heritage. Yeah, I'm not saying that old airfields, particularly, you know, are kind of cultural assets. But if you,
they are. About being, I mean, everything is.
Yeah, everything is. Yeah, okay. So, but the example I was just talking about in Nottingham, they built a new library. So, well, we have a library. It already exists. So, why did you need to build a new one? And what are you going to do with the old one? Right. So it's like, hang on a minute, you've changed the fundamental structure of the city. And actually, at the same time, you've brought in a load of new people, right? Because there's a lot of demographic change in the cities as well. And then at some point in the not too distant future, you've got to think, well, what, you're just going to bulldoze the old town? So now we've got a new town, new people. And you've just done this kind of switcheroo with it. And while we're all still living here in this thing's just trundling along in the background, it's unbelievably sinister.
See, the,
and destructive. Like when you really look what it is.
The other time that you could see this massive driven change was in the 2000s. So, you know, from 2000 onwards, when the European Union was filling this country full of EU money, which local authorities could bid for. And what money am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about funding pots like money from the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development or the European Investment Bank. And when local authorities got hold of this money, it came with conditions. So you can have this money to, quote, regenerate your city. But if you're going to regenerate the city, one, you must put up signs saying, oh, how nice, we got this money from the European Union. But also you must do particular things. And so if you go back to the 2000s, we saw this massive destruction of the identity of our city centres, because cities were regenerating themselves. And what they invariably did is that they converted a throughfare of traffic into a pedestrian city centre. And then they chose precisely the same paving slabs, and they chose the same style of street furniture, lampposts and benches.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's amazing that you're saying this, because I went to college in Carlisle, and that's exactly Carlisle City Centre. It's generic, absolutely generic. You can tell that it used to be a roadway, but it's now entirely pedestrianised. And the bricks, at least at that time, this was the year 2000, I'm imagining this had been done in the 90s, the bricks were those slightly reddish diagonal formation bricks that were everywhere at that time. And it was completely generic. It could have been any time.
And this happened across the country. It happened across the country. And it was very clever in that the whole focus of local authorities pulled away from the grants that they get from central government to function. And their whole focus turned to the EU, where if they submitted a written bid in an appropriate, in a particular way, they could win millions of regeneration money. And then what that money did is absolutely destroyed the national identity of city centres. And it happened everywhere. It happened in it happened in Plymouth, it happened in Bristol, in Glasgow, Leeds, Sheffield, Newcastle, everywhere. And this is why you can now go into city centres across the country. They're soulless. They look the same. They are not even UK. There's something about them. There's a sort of hint of some European styles. This was deliberate policy.
Oh, that was that particular emphasis was made on that, wasn't it? That certainly some of the southern English towns that allegedly have some of the better weather for it, they said, we don't want plebs in pubs anymore. We want terrazzas and trattorias and the artist impressions that were, this was slightly before computer-aided design in the full sense. So it was sort of mainly artist sketches. It all showed, you know, the right kind of people sipping their wine.
Yeah. And I give you a little anecdotal story, which I'm going to say is true, but we have to tell it as an anecdotal story. And that was that when I was watching this stuff happening in Plymouth, I'd been quite friendly with a journalist in one of the local papers. And he was a good guy because he did quite a lot of work on fraud and corruption when newspapers were doing investigative journalism. But one afternoon he called me at about 4:30 and he said, Brian, he said, you never guess where I've been. I've been into a meeting in the city council and Tony Blair's been down here. So Tony Blair was in with Plymouth City Council and the chief executive. And he said they were looking at future plans of the city. And he said, they were using terminology I've never heard before, because it was sort of quasi-military. They were talking about planning areas and development areas and zones. The city was going to have zones. And then he said at one point they were talking about particular demographics of people being allowed to live in a zone or not allowed to live in a zone. And he said it was really quite spooky. And then he said at one point the chief executive said to Tony Blair, but unfortunately in this sort of part of the city, we've got a little bit of trouble getting these policies implemented. And what he meant was there was some pushback from the local people. And the journalist said that Tony Blair turned to the chief executive and said, well, you have been given special powers under the recent legislation on local authorities. You have been given special powers and you should use them. And that journalist called me, and he was unnerved by the nature of the description about the future plan for the city. And that was probably back in about 2006 or sometime like that. And this style of regeneration and control and zoning of the cities has continued apace ever since.
And now we hear about 15-minute cities. So I imagine that would be well, making each zone self-sufficient. I don't know. At least for the citizens. There was one other thing I wanted to talk about, which is you mentioned, I can't remember which of you it was who mentioned this, but the control of land and farming. And this seems to be particularly pertinent this year, because we've seen the Labour government in its first few months alienated many different groups of people. I can't even remember them all now. Pensioners, students, the working class, but also farmers. And this was done with the inheritance tax, and there's been a big controversy this year. And I don't know if it will peter out now. I hope it doesn't. There have been protests and so on. Jeremy Clarkson got on board. And it seems like the idea is to, and this is a general thing, but if inheritance tax so as to denude ordinary people of their inheritance, of what should be theirs, of family, the legacy of a family. That seems to be a general thing. Property everywhere is, I mean, it's I think it's going to become the case that it's, when you inherit a family house, you don't really inherit it because you can't afford the tax on it, so you have to immediately sell it. So what you actually earn, what you actually inherit, is the right and the necessity to sell the house, not to actually own it. That would seem to be the case. But obviously with farms in particular, there's been this specific change. And what that means is that family farms could become a thing of the past, because their only option will be to sell it, and it will be sold probably to BlackRock or some equivalent organization, or a face for that organization, who knows. The implications of that are quite obvious, but would any of you like to take up this topic?
Shall I give a historical perspective?
Yes,
the late Roman Empire degenerated into this mess. I mean, one of the very fundamental socioeconomic issues in the whole of world history is, how is land inheritance arranged? Even quite neighbouring and kindred peoples have different insights, just like the continental Germanics and the English or the Scots have different views on jury trial, with the continentals now saying, we cannot be asked, let the professionals determine our fate for us. And likewise, the continental Germanics, and that includes most of the French, the Franks, the northern two-thirds of France, they have always allowed the parcelling up of land. Traditionally, it would be the sons of a farmer, wouldn't it? A yeoman, a freeholder, which is that sweet spot in the middle where he's not beholden to a lord, but he's not an aristocrat. So that's the layer out of which the continuity and the intellect of the country really comes. And that particular layer is confronted with a problem in any dense, well-civilized society. So ancient Mesopotamia, ancient China, ancient India, ancient Mesoamerica, etc. How do I give eeksy-peeksy to all my sons? Uniquely, the Anglo-Saxons and the Celts, to some extent, certainly as we say, the English and the Scots, wanted entailment of estates. So you couldn't just do what you would do in France or even away in China, which is parcel up into these tiny strips that you see. So one son had to take it. And that's what an entailed estate was. This went on to the 19th century, 20th century. This is also why we had more clout of our aristocracy than the Continentals did, because they would, you know, all the sons of a duke would be count this or that, whereas we would restrict it to, no, you're the firstborn son, you're the new guy, and the spare sons can go off to the army or the church where, you know, they won't do any harm. So that was the attitude of the landowning class. That's where Toryism comes from, for good and for ill in our history. That's the landowning class idea. Right. So that issue, if you now depersonalize it from landowning estates, is how does the land go from generation to generation? Again, the Continentals have got a very different approach because they've got the Napoleonic attitude of you must sell it. So, you know, actually, on the continent, even here in the Netherlands, which has got a better legal system than most, when somebody with more than one child dies, the later surviving spouse in a marriage, it's unthinkable to the British or any other Anglo-Saxons, but you know, often none of the children will inherit the house because it will be sold to a stranger so that everyone gets their entitled fraction. Now, we're quite unusual in that regard. So that's just by way of historical background. If you've grown up and spent all your time in an English-speaking country, you might not be aware of this, that the bulk of the world, including, shall we say, the more civilized or economically advanced nations, have always said, what's the problem here? You just split things up. It's the English-speaking nations, and Britain is the densest and smallest of them, obviously the mother country, where uniquely this issue arises of what are we going to do with this land? Scots law, by the way, is now going, as usual, ahead. It's more of a laboratory for this under the SNP government, but if it switches to a Labour administration, it won't be much different. In the name of justice and equity, they're making moves now towards basically obliging landowners, even in, you know, the famous unproductive, unagricultural land that dominates much of Scotland, moves towards saying you have to sell this for the public good. But, you know, to return to where I began with the late Roman Empire, a bunch of elitists, oligarchs will buy it all up and turn it into a latifundia, you know, and a massive agribusiness which outcompetes everyone else with the low prices which it can afford by setting unlimited slave labor in the fields. And now that's the 21st century, the equivalent will be robots, whatever it may be, you know, minimal staff, and to the extent you need human labor, import directly from the third world. So that's already happening to, you know, in the arable zone in the east of England to a large extent. So the interests of the corporations is obviously rationalized. They tried it just after the Second World War in Benelux. There was a time when the agriculture ministers of Belgium and the Netherlands openly said, away with the small farmer. Then they went underground with these plants. But as usual, it will have a different expression in Britain because of our different sense of what's fair. And once the land has been bought up, and the other thing that's new compared with the last time this happened in the fall of the Roman Empire, is you don't even have to have good arable or good pastoral land anymore, because there are boondoggle ways to make fallow land profitable. Stick wind farms on them, for example, and make the plebs pay for allegedly their energy, sinking the money. And it's just, you know, the great wheeze there is owning the land and pretending that you're providing a public good. But I've been wittering on, so I'll let the other two supplement that.
There is a document written in 2020, the National Food Strategy, which was written by Henry Dimbleby, who is of the Dimbleby clan, and also he was the founder of Leon. I don't know if you know the sort of healthy fast food restaurant. It's quite big in the food space. And this document was written in conjunction with Bain, who are notoriously the most psychotic of the strategy consulting firms. And their strong recommendation after analysing the British food system was that we needed fewer, much, much larger farms, so that those bits of the value chain, as they call it, that bit of the productive capacity that makes up our food supply, can negotiate more effectively and efficiently with the other big corporate parts of the system, like the Tesco's and the Sainsbury's and the other big food manufacturers. Right, that was their recommendation. It was written under a Tory government, but there's been absolutely no change. Bain is a World Economic Forum strategic partner. Starmer's executing World Economic Forum policy. So that's basically the agenda, as far as I can tell. Yeah, they want to collapse all of the family-owned farms, hive them up into a handful of these corporate entities that will be controlled by the BlackRocks and the billionaire types like Bill Gates, who's been into Downing Street over the past month. In fact, even I think the week before the inheritance tax change was announced, he was in Downing Street personally. No one knows what to talk about, although we can probably infer from the fact that he is the largest owner of farmland in the United States that it might have involved farmland in the UK, right?
Well, and it would be a remarkable globalist coincidence. The timing was...
Wouldn't it just?
Yeah.
Astonishing. Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. So that's what they want to do, right? And it's all to benefit the money powers, corporatist overlords. It's got nothing to do with delivering high-quality food to the people of the country, or food security, actually, importantly, to the people of the country. And that's what we're looking at.
It just seems incredible. I can understand from the point of view of BlackRock and huge corporations and billionaires, this seems like a good idea. It's obviously what they will want. Of course it is. But from the point of view of a healthy society, a happy citizenry, and a nice country, it's a terrible, terrible idea. A dreadful way for things to go. Brian, would you like to chip in?
Well, I'm going to be naughty and smile and say, what makes you think they want to create a society where people are happy? The art to understanding what's happening. I've said this now several times on the news. If you can't understand what's happening, try thinking first of all that we are being attacked by our own government, and then consider the policies.
Yeah.
This is an attack on everything about us, our lives, our history, our culture. They are destroying it all, usually to make profit. And that's the simple rule for working out what they're doing. I just wanted to say on the farming that Mike Robinson from the UK column and myself, we actually went up to London to the last big farmers protest, and we were there quite close to the stage, although we're off to one side, so didn't see all the action on the stage, but saw Clarkson and certainly heard what he had to say. But something really made a big impact on me on that day, and that was that the farming community up there, because there were male, female farmers, but farmers and their families and relations, they were all white. They were all white people. And I'm going to say the ones we spoke to, and we did speak to a lot of them, were really nice people. They were, I'm going to say, salt to the earth. They were long-established farming families from across the country. And they've been involved in their small farms through generations. And they were lovely people, but they were all white. And to me, I looked at them and I thought, you are to be wiped out. And I think part of the attack on them is to destroy the cultural aspect. They are generational farmers. They got generational knowledge of the land and the soil conditions and how to farm their individual small farms. And they are to be wiped out, to be replaced by these large conglomerates, which, as Ben and Alex have talked about, fit the supply chains with the supermarkets. So I did feel very sad because they were such nice people. And the other thing was, it was clear they did not have a clue what the real Labour policy was about, because it's not just about inheritance tax. It's about these huge commercial farms, which will be under the control of a land manager. That's the title they're using, not a farmer, a land manager.
That's what the Latin latifundi had, these abusive guys who just managed the slaves while the absentee landlord raked in the money.
Right. And then the other bit is that farms are not going to be about food. They're going to be about, as I think was mentioned, they're going to be about other things. They're going to be about solar farms. They're going to be about windmills. They are going to be about rewilding, cutting back on agriculture and food production in order to rewild the countryside. And they are also now going to be about planting trees for carbon capture. And all of these policies are absolutely detailed the moment you go near the United Nations and the World Economic Forum sustainable goals. The documents are all there telling you that these are the policies that are going to be implemented.
If I may just close.
Let me just pick up on that. What you said about the farmers all being white, that does link with Jeremy Clarkson's, I think, rather offhand remark that Labour wanted to ethnically cleanse the countryside of farmers. But I think there was truth in that. Yeah. And it also links with this whole myth that's being created, or they're trying to create this myth of the countryside being racist, because there just aren't enough non-whites there. It's just it seems very English. It seems very ethnic and so on. So that, and then also what you just said there about the World Economic Forum and the UN, they signal all of this. It's very out in the open. This is what they want. They're not actually hiding it. It's So anyway, Alex, you wanted to chime in.
Yes, just picking up on that very point. We had this in microcosm with the Northern Ireland Troubles. The both of the communities in Northern Ireland had farms, but deep agrarian existence was much more associated with the rural Roman Catholic population further out from Belfast, around the border in particular. And the smartest retrospective I had ever read of the Troubles, I think it was shared by somebody linked with Gates of Vienna, if you remember those early days of the ethno-nationalist scene online. A paper, I have no reason to doubt the authorship. It was by a retired MI5 type, or military intelligence type, who actually loved the country for once and was prepared to share his wisdom with us. He said, well, look, unless you go scorched earth policy, which only Russia does when it has insurgencies or like country like that, there is no way that we could have managed to beat the Republican terrorist movements, because they had redoubts, REDOUBT, from French Redoui. They could fall back, not on mountain fastnesses in their case, but South Armagh farmsteads where they could have their weapons caches, they could recuperate their fighters. And that stuck with me, because he was writing in the 2010s when it looked like we were going to have the Pakistanis raised up as an army against the whites in at least a belt of English towns. And he said, basically, have no fear, because they don't farm. And that's very slow to change. Very, very few Muslims in Britain are interested in farming, but generally they don't. So he said, have no fear, because if you're purely an urban population, even if you dominate, for example, Birmingham, you can be cleared up. And that the French army seem to have more advanced plans for this when things go south ethnically than we do. So that's a fair enough point. But if you reverse engineer the whole thing, we don't stand a chance against the Globo army, if we no longer have farms to fall back on? You know, obviously the parallel is not complete, because with electronic and satellite surveillance and heat seeking and whatnot, digital tracking, it will be much harder in the insurgencies of the 21st century than it was before to hide your fighters and your weapons. But you have not a chance at all, humanly speaking, if you don't have the farmsteads. So I think that's why the whites, the British people, are being cleared off the farms.
Yeah, it's amazing the scale of what appears to be happening here and being instituted. Ben, you look like you want to say something.
Yeah, well, I'll say a few things. I'll just respond to what you just said there, right, which is it is absolutely mind-boggling, the scale of this. This is a full-system, multi-dimensional assault on the nation-state, right? It's absolutely everywhere in the existing system. Like it's astonishing when you dig into it. And the more I research it, the more complex it gets. Like the layer, just layers upon layers upon layers of this stuff, right? And it's all heading in the same direction, right? So, you know, we report on it, but actually, in many ways, looking at that for too long, it's important to look at it and to understand it, but actually, thinking about parallel systems and breaking away from it is even more important for my money, and particularly the next 12 months. That's what I'm personally very interested in. And I'm really glad that you've got Simon Woodlander coming up next, because he's really walking the walk on that front. And people hang around and wait for that stream, because that's going to be a really good one. Just a quick comment on the Jeremy Clarkson. That comment, I don't think that was casual. I think that was deliberately provocative. I will just say that. Right, I'm not sure that I trust Jeremy Clarkson and anyone sort of leading out the charge for the farmers currently in the mainstream. I don't think that they're trustworthy. And actually, in terms of the viewers and like anyone who's watching this, the most important and valuable things that we can all collectively do right now is to help connect the farmers directly with consumers, right, to circumvent the current distribution and supply chains, current retail infrastructure. Like the more that we can buy direct and get money to the farmers, the better, yeah, across the whole country. So just bear that in mind and get active if you can in that regard. And then beyond that, if you've got land and or you've got access to land, someone else's land, get planting stuff, right? Seriously, start growing food, because the food supply chain is a real weak point for us collectively in this country. Like we're a net importer of food. We are not self-reliant, and we need to get to the point where we are again. And you know, that's certainly doable, but in the next, that's not an immediate thing, right? So the more that we can all actively get involved with producing our own food and supporting the farming community, the better. Right? Just from a national security perspective, that is number one top priority, I think.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I mean, I think a lot of people find the idea exciting of people being self-sufficient, allotments, gardens, the kind of stuff that happened during the war, even though, you know, leaving all the issues of that aside, it's just nice to think of people being self-sufficient and growing their own and so on. Yeah, it's a whole thing, because I was doing research about that as well for one of my essays. I can't remember which one. But yeah, this is all, I think it might become a dire necessity. And of course, this is the kind of thing that the government will also step in to try to legislate against, to try to... The best thing just now about the chickens, and it just seems so ridiculous and petty and laughable, but this is the kind of thing that people should be careful about laughing at, because it's serious. Yeah. I mean, they're not joking. All right,
it's very serious. And actually, I was listening to, sorry, just one last thing. I listened to your stream with Marta Maid a couple of days ago, who I had not come across before, and it was exceptional. And I've subsequently gone off and listened to a bunch of his stuff, and there's this podcast he's done called The Anti-Humans, which is about what the Bolsheviks did in Poland and Ukraine. And one of their primary channels of attack was the food supply and frankly starving populations, right? And if you look at the way that the state in this country is currently behaving and the things that it's perfectly happy to do, we've all seen over the past, well, long time now, but certainly the past 4 years. And if we are to understand, as Brian highlighted, that we're actually being attacked, then you've got to take this stuff extremely seriously. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm amazed that anyone at this point can still think that this is accidental or it's happening just because of incompetence or whatever. I mean, when people call the government idiots, they're getting it all wrong. You know, oh, dear. It's certainly not accidental. Well, that links with our first super chat, which is from the Woodlander. And he says, great panel. Would you agree that building our own systems, platforms, businesses, organizations separate from the current control system that work, the things that work for our benefit is the way forward? Brian.
It's exactly what we should do. And if we want to, if we want to talk about some success when people are doing that, the first thing we can point at is what we're doing this evening. It's alternative, it's new media, which has now got to such a strength that it's clear that the government and the established mainstream media and TV, the BBC, are terrified of the people who are now new media broadcasters. So ordinary people just getting into the field and saying, we can broadcast, we can run news, we can do it better than the BBC and the national papers. That's had a huge effect. And then we're seeing people doing other really great things. We're seeing people who are now going into their local council, their district council or their county council, and challenging the members directly on the floor about the policies that they're making. So if you go on to YouTube, you can see Council Watch, which started off just as an agenda of one lady. That's now grown into other areas. So that's another really good one, which comes off the top of my head. But we've also had simple things like in lockdown, people were challenging it by going and standing in the park. So every time we say we're going to build something ourselves, we're not going to do what the state wants us to do, this is causing them problems. And we can almost measure their problems by the fact that if we look at organizations like the World Economic Forum, with increasing frequency, they're now talking about the fact that their plans are running slow. They're not meeting their own timescales for delivery. And why not? Because of the resistance which is coming from ordinary people doing relatively small things. We don't want what are the traffic zones called? Sorry, of low
15-minute cities.
Yeah, but we've
low traffic neighborhoods.
Thank you. Low traffic neighborhoods, we're not having them. We're going to protest. We're going to move the barriers. That's caused huge problems. So absolutely. And we need millions of people just doing little things to absolutely mess up this globalist agenda.
Yeah, indeed. And then Monty Fontaine asks, does UK Column have any white pills at all? Do they believe these people will get away with the global governance plans? Cheers. Well, that links kind of with what Brian was just saying. But Ben, would you like to take that?
Yes, I'm actually very white-pilled. So, you know, as I was kind of touching on a minute ago, a lot of what I spend my time doing is looking at the atrocious corruption. But actually, I'm extremely optimistic about our prospects for breaking free and building a new system or new, really micro systems, right? It's going to be a very devolved, distributed model is the term that I use, right? There's going to be much less centralization and back towards something that's, I'm not suggesting that we're going to transport ourselves back to the 18th century or anything like that, right? Like, I think that the future we're going to move into will be in some ways more old-fashioned, but also in many ways much more futuristic than what we have now. It's going to be a combination of those two things. But ultimately, it's our gift to build that, right? And if you think about, you know, people get very het up about the likes of Elon Musk and these billionaires and all their money, and they're so powerful. If you look at someone like Musk, for example, his total wealth is, I think it was just announced the other day that he was worth $400 billion. Right. Well, the industrial output, the gross domestic product of the UK is £2.5 trillion a year. Yeah. Not just a static number. This is per annum. Right. So actually the industrial output, the potential economic output of the British population vastly exceeds anything that any of these billionaires has the capacity to deploy. Right. So actually, if we can get organized and we can really think about what are the component parts of the system that we need to have in place in order to thrive as a civilization, and then collaborate at a local level to build those, as well as regionally and nationally, and get moving, then we don't even need to think about the global system too much. There'll be plenty of things that they'll throw into the mix to try to scupper our plans. But if there's enough activity going on around the country, I don't think that they'll be able to stay ahead of us. I just don't think that they will. And actually, if you look at their enormous, I can't remember who I was talking to the other day, but basically someone saying, and it was probably a quote, so I'm going to bastardize from someone, right? But it's basically the downfall, or the seeds of the downfall of every tyrannical power exist within its formulation. That was a horrible way of saying it, right? But it's something like that. And I think that the real problem that this current technocratic system has got is its massive over-reliance on technology, right? And actually the people that have signed up to it are fundamentally corruptible and weak. Right, and actually, like, what we need is some good, solid citizens to step up, get their hands dirty, roll their sleeves up, get working, be honest, be forthright, do things for the right reasons, and they just won't be able to compete with it. Yeah. And I'm very excited about what the next 12 months, 24 months is going to look like.
Can I add one bit to that?
Certainly.
And that is that it's easy to look at the power that we're lined up against. It's these immensely powerful people who control nations, who control trillions of dollars, who control armies, who control police forces. But they have all this power and all this control and even all the assets and the money they do. But for their system to work, it has to work at the lowest level. And when people at the bottom level in the parish council, in the street, say, no, we're not having this, that's what causes the problem. This is why they need this devolved system of government and sortition, where they're going to get people at local level to rule themselves for the state. But basically, if people at the lowest level simply say no, and we're going to do it our way, all of the control structure of the global government is irrelevant.
Yep.
That's the bit which people miss, because they're always looking for the savior who's going to be some political leader up here, up high. But you don't need that. What you need to be doing is you want thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people saying no at street level.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you've got a problem with the, and they've said this themselves, there was that woman, I think she was American, about a year ago, maybe less than that, and she said the problem we have is that they don't trust us. Yeah. It was something about the elite. I think that she actually used that word.
Dame Nairi Marsh.
Nigel Woods.
Woods. Nairi Woods. Yes. And a pure New Zealander who was brought over to. And the first one who was clueless enough to refer to her chums as we the elite. You know, real head girl vibes of, I have been promoted. You know, it's very, very telltale. The quotation that Ben alluded to, I think verbatim, is, every tyranny carries within itself the seeds of its own destruction. And I think it's a Roman author, but I can't remember off the top of my head who it is.
I knew you'd rescue me, Alex.
Yeah, and what Brian said, you know, about not looking for a Trump, but, well, he didn't say Trump in narrow sense, but not looking for a hero. Again, just keeping it with America's, I mean, since we mentioned Trump, they have had saviours of this kind who have interdicted and interposed state and federal orders, county sheriffs, who have said, in my county and in a British model, this would be down to a parish. If you had the gumption to elect a parish constable, which is still in our law and our constitution, you can say within this area, even if it's just a couple of square miles, that wicked law will not be enforced.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. There's obviously a lot that needs to be done here in terms of research first to find out things like that. Parish constable, that's a term I've never even heard before. And probably many people have never heard that before. So a lot of knowledge needs to be found and spread, I think. And I hope that that's a project for the next 5 years or so for all of us to be involved with. Okay, Darby said, inheritance tax is just evil and immoral, in my opinion. I agree. It's a very simple thing. I could see an argument for a very small inheritance tax, but I think inherently it's just immoral, because whatever the asset is, it's already been taxed. It just seems like a sick way to destroy intergenerational wealth and the importance of families and dynasties and tradition. So I agree, it's evil and immoral. Hal 9000 said, in the age of mobile phones, few understand the suffering of he who is cursed with sausage fingers. Now, I understand what you're saying. I don't know if it's an allusion to King Charles or not, but the point is noted. Now, also, Mousecat said, just made a donation and said, here you go, bruv, good stuff. Thank you very much, Mousecat. And also, Unorthodox Normie said, it's quite amusing to hear the term loony left again. Mm. Is it still a fitting evaluation of left-wing politics? That's a really complicated question, which if it came up on my AMA tomorrow night, I would probably spend about 20 minutes talking about it, but because there's a lot to it. I'll ask Alex, for example. Well, do you think the loony left is a fitting description of left-wing politics?
It can't be now. It came about 50 years ago, more or less, because before local government was particularly axed, and we have to remember this was two successive conservative prime ministers who did it. Jim Callaghan came in between them, but it was Heath and Thatcher in 74 and 86, wasn't it, who axed a lot of local government and abolished it. Before that, you had real power in, for example, the Greater London Assembly, and that was where the heat of the battle was, and in the city councils, Liverpool is a notable example, where, okay, the term loony left was brought in because the idea was, it was a continental style, we are not putting up with this anymore, a French or Spanish style manning of barricades, at least metaphorically. That has given way to a more savvy way of doing politics. The Corbynistas and their successors in and out with the Labour Party and in the Celtic fringe, where they won't normally be in the Labour Party anymore, they have conceded that you have to give the people what they want and move with the times. So just in the social terms of what the loony left was, you know, it was associated with badly dressed beardies and frumpy women who were banging on about things of no interest to the British people, like faraway wars. Okay, the continuity you can see between 40, 50 years ago and now, because that's still a factor. But the difference is now such people will be going on about sexual liberation and everyone having the right identity. You know, that cultural Marxist element, I think, has removed any justification for the use of the term loony left anymore.
All right, all right. And Brian, do you remember the loony left from the 80s? I'm going to assume that Ben doesn't. But Brian.
Yeah, well, yeah, yes, I do. But of course, it was a term, to my recall, it was a term that was particularly loved by the media in order to ridicule anybody in the labour movement who was challenging the proper view, which they tended to believe rested within the sort of conservative view, the Conservative Party view on politics. So I think the loony left was always used to cover a very wide spectrum. It could be Labour left campaigning against nuclear weapons. They could be described as a loony left. Or it could be, give me another good example, Alex.
Well, early multicultural.
It was the militant tendency if you remember Derek Hatton in Liverpool.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a strain and it's a label for various phenomena in British politics.
Well, yeah, but it was derogatory. It was, in my opinion, it was overwhelmingly derogatory, so that any left-leaning opinion which challenged a perceived conservative centre ground, that's how you demolished it, by calling it
reached fever pitch in 1983, because as well as Labour losing comprehensively to a second Thatcher term, there was a struggle for the leadership of the Labour Party. Kinnock ended up taking the leadership, but shortly before that, there was level pegging fight. Sorry, it was during that, wasn't it? Because it was the fight for who would be deputy under Kinnock and therefore likely next Labour leader when they got into office again in the 90s. So it was who was going to be the Blair figure, as it were. That fight was for deputy leader was between Tony Benn, the good guy, the descendant of Puritan Christian ideals in socialism, really, and Dennis Healey, the utterly compromised Bilderberger. And Healey got it. But it was just a whisker.
But also in 1983, that was when Ken Livingstone's GLC was at its crazy peak as well. So there was a lot going on. The loony left is a big story. And this is why I embarked on a project writing about it, quickly got overwhelmed. I realized this is going to take ages. I have to write other essays in order to make my living. So I couldn't concentrate on it. This was a year ago now.
Has been piqued, just look for ILEA, I-L-E-A, the Inner London Education Authority, from about 83 to 86. That was the bane of the Education Secretary's existence, Kenneth Baker, at the time. And that's a story in itself.
A huge number of stories in there, actually. But yeah, and the interesting thing about all of this is that it shows that the crazy stuff, what we now call wokery, or some people now call wokery, was there 40 years ago. And this is what's so amazing about it.
It's almost as if, shall I go straight in at the deep end and say this? It's almost as if the senior, mostly Labour Party politicians and senior police of the time were raping children in police stations and council offices all over in London back then. And it's almost as if they were wanting to legalise the sodomy of small children back then, isn't it? I mean, you know, perish the thought that such a thing was going on 40, 50 years ago. And coordinated between Britain, the Netherlands, Belgium and France. But if you posited that was actually what was going on, then it's no surprise that we now have wokery and sexualization of children.
Well, indeed. And back then you had the paedophile information exchange and so forth. Yeah, as I said, there's a lot to it. But let's not go into it now, because we are overdue. And I think this has been a good conversation in itself. So I don't want to bring the loony left into it in a big way. Let me just check. That's all fine. Okay. Yeah, someone says that the series GBH was based upon that kind of thing, the militant tendency in Liverpool. But yeah, the series GBH was, I think, about 1990, mm-hmm. if I recall correctly. I've never seen it, but I've got the DVD. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. All right. Any final words before we end this stream? Ben?
Final words.
Just for one year.
Hey?
Just for this year.
Okay, right.
Well, unless we all get targeted by Israel's AI.
Well, yeah, you never know what's going to happen, right? I would just, I mean, the most important things I wanted to say, actually, I summed up a minute ago as it relates to farming and supporting farmers and getting actively involved in the food supply, right? That's really important. So I'll just reiterate that. But beyond that, I would say watch the UK column and support the UK column because we're doing good work. And thank you very much for having us back this year. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. And Alex, any last thoughts?
Next year, God willing, we will be continuing on the theoretical and the practical. The practical, I suspect, will largely be farming and food production. We've ramped up a lot on that. And the theoretical will be a renewed focus on one of our classic strands, which is constitutional knowledge. So that's, you know, in our ideal self-contained, self-sufficient community, when everyone has their downtime and is not online and retires to a communal hall or whatever it may be, they will actually have to learn what it is that made them break away from the system and start again and what it is that they are preserving. So they'll need to know their constitutional rights, their inalienable rights. So we'll be going to town on that again. Look out particularly for the fine UK column author, Philip Ridley. In fact, if you go to ukcolumn.org/writer/Philip-Ridley, you'll find four articles, the two latter of which go into detail on what we've been discussing this evening, the idea of Parliament being kept out of war powers and the role of the House of Commons Library. So a lot of the things we're discussing this evening, you should read in the light of those two articles. And he will be coming on board at some point to podcast with us on the Constitution.
All right. Excellent. Brian? Hold on. Yeah. Right. Okay. Go.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Matt. Well, of course, I'd like to encourage people to come and have a look at the UK column and to say that all of our news programs that we do, we're giving the evidence. We're usually looking and commenting on documents, and the show notes always back this up by showing you where we've got the material from. So encourage you to come and have a look at us. But more general statement I wanted to make, and to be very positive, is that one of the places that I think demonstrate that we, as a pretty widespread group of people, are making progress, is that you can see the quality of social media is improving. There are so many people who are doing interviews, or they're making little documentaries, or they're putting up clips and commenting on them. I see the overall standard is increasing all the time. And I think that this is really brilliant, because this is challenging the bad guys who want to control all the media. And they expected social media to just degenerate into a very childish, squabbly mess. But when I look at all sorts of reports across social media, whether it's YouTube or other platforms, I'm seeing better and better quality information. It's almost like the amateurs are building on each other. And so the quality of that analysis and the news reporting, and you know, Colin, you're one of the people out there. We're doing it ourselves, but there are many others. I think we need to be really positive about the great progress that's been made. And the thing that's happening with it is that we're starting to see easy dialogue spreading across quite diverse groups. I mean, I'm seeing, particularly in relation to what's happening in the Middle East, that you've got people on the right wing and the left wing side who are now actually starting to say, yeah, we all agree this is wrong. So I'm going to say, I think we're starting to make some real progress, not only in media, but getting on with each other as human beings, because ultimately, to defeat this monster, we've got to stand together. And it doesn't matter whether you're slightly, well, whether you think you're right or left, or you're white or brown or Catholic or Muslim, the monster's going to get all of us, and we need to work together.
All right. Those are very good last words. Okay, well, this has been a very interesting stream, so thank you very much for appearing again, and thank you for arranging it. I know it's difficult to get a slot when it's three different people involved, so I'm grateful that was done. Okay, I will be back imminently with The Woodlander, but in the meantime, UK Column, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right. See you all later.
Okay, bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.